Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Dermot McCulloch about his new book, Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life. Dermot, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm a professor of the history of the church in the University of Oxford in the UK. And I'm, as you can guess, a historian, and I've been a historian throughout my career. I went to Cambridge University in England, and there did a doctorate on Tudor history under the great Tudor historian, Sir Geoffrey Elton. And from there, I taught in a seminary, a Methodist seminary, and later in my career, I came to Oxford. I've been in Oxford for nearly a quarter of a century. And during that time, I've written a lot on Tudor England in various ways. I've written another big biography of Thomas Cromwell's great friend, Archbishop Thomas Cranmer. That was about a quarter of a century ago. And also, I've written more widely on the history of the church, so a history of the whole European Reformation. And also, after that, expanding still further, a history of all Christianity, everywhere, at all times. I called it Christianity the First 3,000 Years. But Thomas Cromwell is my latest book.
So you've had this progression from talking about this one figure in the Anglican Church in the 16th century to talking about all of the history of Christianity. What brought you back to talking about a contemporary of Cranmer's?
Well, I thought I'd ranged widely enough for the time being. I did that entire general history. I then wrote a book on silence as a theme in Christian history. So that's taking very wide subjects. And I thought after that, something which I've been thinking about for a long time, getting back to Thomas Cromwell, which is a very different sort of book, because those books were about synthesizing, gathering the fruits of scholarship from lots of other people. This book was about going to the archives of the Kingdom of England, which are still in the National Archives in London, and going through document by document to get a sense of what Thomas Cromwell was like. Very different process. Fascinating. I like both sorts of history, but this was a big project.
One of the things that I really enjoyed in your book was that you make your engagement with the documents part of your narrative. And it's a fascinating examination as to how to not just take the, you know, not where you're getting the documents from and the fact that we're still uncovering documents about Cromwell's life, but also how you're explaining their interpretation and how to read it, in some respects, as they would be understood by a 16th century man such as Cromwell versus how we might interpret it in the modern times.
Yes, and that's what I hope the reader will enjoy, because I invite the reader to come with me, and I'm the guide into those back corridors where the documents are stored, and taking out each one and putting it in its place. The archive which I was using, which is huge, is part of, I'd say, the government archive of England, and it's been available to the public for the last 150 years or so. And it is the personal papers, by and large, of Thomas Cromwell, confiscated from his archive when he was arrested by King Henry VIII, and they've been lying in the National Archives ever since. They were catalogued and arranged by Victorian archivists in the 19th century. And as they did it, and it was a heroic job, they, of course, made mistakes about how to date things and the significance of them. And so one of my jobs was to go through the listings which they'd made and which they'd put into print and just test every document with what you might call a hermeneutic of suspicion. You go to the document and you say, right, you prove to me that you are actually from 1533 and not from 1537. So I put that spotlight on each document, and most of them passed, but interestingly, a lot didn't. And then I would have to fish them out of the Victorian arrangement and put them in their right place in the jigsaw. That was fascinating.
It really is interesting to see how you do that process in the book. And yet you also explain that for all the wealth that exists in this archive, that there are huge gaps in our understanding of Thomas Cromwell's life. We aren't even entirely certain about the pronunciation of his last name. And this, of course, comes out most dramatically in terms of talking about his childhood and his early years.
Yes, because he was from a very obscure background in a very obscure village upstream up the River Thames from London. And you wouldn't expect much documentation about this sort of person. And then, of course, he fled from his home village to Italy, where he was still a humble person. So unless he paid taxes or committed a crime, you wouldn't expect him to turn up in the archive. It was only when he became a person of importance, which was very late in his career, really in his late 30s, that you start getting the volume of documentation, his own papers, things which people wrote to him, mentions in lawsuits, in the legal records of the Kingdom of England. So the early life is really quite difficult to get hold of, to get a hold on.
And as you mentioned as well, that at the end of his life, facing an impending imprisonment and trial, that he also purged through some of those documents. So there are gaps that are in the record.
Yeah, I think not him, but his household. So the sequence of things was that he was arrested very suddenly in the year 1540 by the king's agents. And the household would be confronted with this extraordinary turnaround in his fortunes. And my interpretation of what they did to the archive was that they destroyed half of it. And what they destroyed were the copies of the letters which he would have written to other people. So we've got thousands of letters in the archive written to him. In old-fashioned terms, if looking at an old-fashioned desk, you'd call that the in-tray. And what's missing is the out-tray, the documents which he created, he signed, the letters he wrote. And he would have kept copies of those, and they've all gone. Now, what I think must have happened was that the household systematically destroyed them, burnt them. They must have sat up night after night burning them. And why do you do that? It's because you're likely to be convicted on what you say to other people, not what they say to you. You can always explain that away. So it was a good try to try and save their master. It didn't work because he was beheaded, executed by Henry VIII, but it was a good try. But what it's done is left us without his voice. It's very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's intriguingly and enjoyably difficult to get the sense of him talking. All the archive, all those documents virtually are the impress of him on other people and how they react to him. So that was my job, to just get the traces of his voice from this interestingly skewed but huge archive. I mean, it took me 5 years just sitting down with the documents, going through them one by one, trying to get the right order, trying to see the patterns within them. And then I started writing the book.
Let's start talking about Cromwell's life by talking about those early years that he was growing up. You described that his family was very humble. How does he go from these humble beginnings to having a public career?
He ran away. He ran away from home. And he didn't just run up to London, which is a matter of 5 or 6 miles away. No, he went to Italy, which is a really ambitious thing to do. It shows you the sort of potential this boy had. And in Italy, he was still absolutely no one. And the one story which seems to give us a clue, shed some light on what happened, is a sort of romance written about 20 years after his death by an Italian novelist. And it tells the story of an utterly penniless teenager on the streets of Florence, the great city of Florence, the greatest cultural center in Italy, the greatest cultural center of the known world at that stage, therefore. There he is on the streets, and a young merchant from a very important family in Florence called Frescobaldi took pity on him and took him into the household and employed him and made him an administrator. And that's probably true, because this Frescobaldi family were great merchants who traded with England. They traded wine up to Northern Europe, and from Northern Europe, and England in particular, they got cloth. And this trade had gone on since the 13th century with this Frescobaldi family. They still exist, incidentally. They're still there in Florence selling wine. And you can see why this boy might have been useful. Once they spotted his intelligence, they could use him in this international trade. And so we get traces of him in the great international exchange city of Antwerp in the Low Countries, now Belgium. And there are little other traces in Southampton, which is the English port through which the Italian wine trade went. So it's fascinating bits of the jigsaw, and that took him to the 1520s. And then something rather dramatic happened. He, from being this interesting, busy, successful in a very minor way, sort of a merchant and lawyer, was taken up by the greatest man in the realm after the king, Cardinal Thomas Wolsey. Now there's a sudden transformation of fortunes. I can date it quite precisely, 1524, and by that stage he was nearly 40. So it's a long time to wait to get yourself on the national stage, and even then he was just a servant of the cardinal.
You describe the skill set that he brings to the cardinal's service, and it makes it understandable why he stood out to Wolsey. He described how during his time on the continent, he would have picked up these languages, and he seems to be a very versatile servant. And yet it's more than just his language skills that he brings to the service, isn't it?
Well, the language skill is absolutely crucial. That no one seemed to notice this before. That's what made the difference. Speaking fluent Italian, and the point is something quite special here, because the cardinal had decided. Cardinal Wolsey was the greatest man in the land. He was also hugely extravagant and was determined to make his mark on history. And the way you did that in the 16th century was to build your own tomb while you're still alive, and to make it the most magnificent tomb possible in Wolsey's case. And there was competition for the best tomb in England at the time, because it was already won, and it was the tomb of King Henry VIII's father, Henry VII, and you can still see it if you go to Westminster Abbey. It is magnificent, and it is made by Italian sculptors. So Wolsey had to have something even better than King Henry VII, and he had to have it made by Italian sculptors. But who would do the negotiation with them? Just the artistic negotiation, apart from anything else. Can you imagine the cardinal not liking the way his nose looked on his sculpture? And you need someone to go to the temperamental Italian sculptor and say, Master Rovizzano, the cardinal doesn't quite like the nose. Do you think you could just tweak it a bit and do that with a little joke and smooth over any ill feelings? And then, of course, report back to the cardinal in English. So you need someone who is the best Italian in England, and that was Thomas Cromwell. After those years in Florence and the other great cities of Italy, that's the skill which the cardinal particularly wanted from this otherwise apparently undistinguished lawyer.
You make this very interesting point there, which is something that I think gets back to what you were saying earlier about the absence of his voice, which is the degree to which Cromwell was a really capable manager of people. And how difficult that is to sometimes access in some of these documents.
Yes, exactly. And what has often come across in previous accounts of his life was the cold bureaucrat, because that's the sort of papers we've got. We've got lots and lots of administrative papers. My great old doctoral supervisor, Sir Geoffrey Elton, was fascinated by that side of Cromwell. And his Cromwell came across as a bit of a machine, if you know what I mean. But what I found was a man who clearly made friends very easily and had charm and a certain rather dark wit as well. And that got him further than just being a busy administrator. But oddly, doing the administration for the cardinal gained him friends, because the job was not just negotiating the tomb, it was providing the finance for the institutions around the tomb, which were colleges, big colleges of priests to pray for the cardinal's soul. And they would be the, again, usual Wolsey, they were the best and most magnificent colleges anywhere in England. And they're, of course, very expensive to found. So Wolsey decided to dissolve small monasteries which he regarded as not doing much of a job. And it was Cromwell who did that. That involved traveling across most of lowland England. And you can see him building up friendships as he went, which would last for the rest of his career. So these are the foundations of the sort of relationships which he would have when he went on to an even greater service under the king himself, King Henry VIII.
Now, all of this is happening in an England which at this time is almost overwhelmingly Catholic, and yet it's on the cusp of this important historical transition point. I was wondering if you could maybe widen our scope a bit, talk a bit about that context, how that affects Wolsey, and how Cromwell then transitions from service to Wolsey, which you would think, given what's going to happen a few years afterward, is going to effectively doom his career, to serving the king himself.
Yeah, well, the European Reformation had exploded in 1517, which is 7 years before Cromwell entered the cardinal service. And you'd expect a good servant of the cardinal to be a good, loyal son of the church, but it's quite clear that he was becoming already a Protestant, a follower of the Reformation, which had started with Martin Luther in Wittenberg in Germany and had spread to other great centers in Switzerland, Zurich, and was now beginning to affect England. Despite the cardinal's best efforts and despite the king, who was a very devout Catholic at that stage, trying to persecute Protestants, Cromwell was quietly using the cardinal's colleges to place young men who were interested in the Reformation in a position to influence the University of Oxford. And he imported such young men, academics, to Oxford from the University of Cambridge to do this. And much was the scandal when it was revealed that they were Protestants. The name of Cromwell didn't come up. So already under the cardinal, Cromwell was a Protestant, a quiet Protestant, quietly using the cardinal's very Catholic project for his own end. And then the cardinal, Wolsey, failed to do the great thing which the king wanted, and that was to get rid of his first marriage. His first marriage was to Catherine of Aragon. It had produced only one daughter, and King Henry VIII was paranoid about having a male heir to the throne, a man to succeed him. Catherine wouldn't deliver the goods. At the same time, the king fell in love with an extremely spirited, intelligent, personable lady, Anne Boleyn, and was determined to marry her. And the cardinal's job was to say that marriage number one to Catherine of Aragon had never happened. Really difficult job, impossible, in fact, because the Pope would never agree. Pope had other concerns behind him, even more powerful monarchs. So Wolsey fell on those grounds, and particularly pressing his fall on the king was that lady Anne Boleyn, who decided that the cardinal was her enemy. And so between Henry's sense of frustration and Anne's determination to destroy the cardinal, and he was forced out of power in 1529. Now, what would Cromwell do as Wolsey's servant? Well, he did something rather subtle. He didn't desert the cardinal, as so many of the cardinal servants did, to scuttle away. No, he stayed with the cardinal, but he also entered the king's service. So now, in 1529-30, he was serving two masters. And the way he did this rather difficult thing was precisely the tomb again. Because the king stripped Wolsey of his landed property when the cardinal was made to resign, but also literally stripped him of his tomb. It was still not complete. It was in workmen's warehouses in Westminster, and so he took the tomb for himself, and who better to go on negotiating with those Italian craftsmen but the arch-Italian Englishman Thomas Cromwell. So that's what he did for the king to start with. That's how he entered the king's service.
And he quickly transitions from there to a seat in one of the most momentous parliaments in all of English history.
Yes, the great parliament, which was called by the Victorians the Reformation Parliament, because that was its great business. It gave its consent to the break between England and Rome, the Pope, which had been a relationship there for 1,000 years, and now with Parliament's consent, the king was recognized as supreme head of the church, which from Henry VIII's point of view was simply to get him his marriage to Anne Boleyn, the declaration that he was a free man to marry. But it would become something much more, because this independent Church of England would now be pulled towards the Protestant Reformation, which need not have happened. It could simply have been a fragment of the universal Catholic Church under the supreme headship of Henry VIII. No, thanks primarily to this man, Thomas Cromwell, who was steadily rising in the king's esteem and rising in power, it was pulled towards the Reformation, bit by bit, the Reformation happening across the water. And Parliament was there. Thomas Cromwell was a member of this parliament, as he had been the previous parliament in 1523, even before he'd entered the king, the cardinal's service. But now, he was clearly fascinated by parliament. And now what he said to the king was, look, don't just do this momentous thing, breaking with Rome by some proclamation, which is bound to cause trouble in the kingdom. Why don't you get the kingdom to consent in its formal institution, Parliament, the Lords and the Commons, the bishops and the abbots assembled at Westminster in Parliament. If they say that you are supreme head, if they recognize you as supreme head, that will be a much stronger thing. So I think that's the great idea which he brought to the king, which had such consequences. Because the English Parliament from then on, right up to the present day, became central to English government. And virtually every other parliament in medieval Europe, and virtually everywhere had parliaments, virtually every other parliament withered away during the 16th century, but not the English Parliament. With this great thing that it did in the 1530s, this momentous break with Rome, it was doing something far more important than it had ever done. And that gave it the precedent of doing other very important things as years went by. So this seems to me to be one of the main reasons for remembering Thomas Cromwell, because he's the heart of this great revolution in making England a place where Parliament mattered beside the king.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It also gets to another part of his life that I think is difficult to access, but you have already highlighted, which is the notion of management skills. How does a king get his agenda, his measures through parliament? And it seems that, and this is something that you see, kings having to turn to as parliament establishes itself, which is this notion of a good manager, a good person manager, a good parliamentary manager. And it seems that Cromwell really is the first of these truly great parliamentary managers who can get the king's business through.
Yes, and precisely in the commons, which are the representatives of the towns of England and the counties, the shires of England, had been a junior partner all the time. That the House of Lords, the nobility, was where things had previously been mattered. But Cromwell was a member of Parliament, a member of the Commons. And so he was managing all this situation within the Commons, and I think clearly fascinated by doing this. And as you say, the very first person to do this, there would be many more parliamentary managers as the years went by. But this was the precedent for so much else. Of course, he did, in the end, become a member of the House of Lords. But by then, the great break with Rome had been cemented into place, and the first steps were being made to pull the Church of England into the Reformation.
You've already mentioned the role that Anne Boleyn is playing in politics, and there is this popular perception of Thomas Cromwell as sort of Anne's agent, or that Anne is Anne is Cromwell's patron, and you argue that that is a misunderstanding of their relationship.
Yes, and I guess this may be one of the biggest changes in the picture of Cromwell that my book puts forward. This image of Anne and Cromwell as close allies in pushing forward the Protestant Reformation is very old. It goes right back into the 1560s, and it was created by certain tactful silences on the part of the great historian of the Protestant Reformation, John Fox. Fox, who created a book called Acts and Monuments, which we come to know as Fox's Book of Martyrs. And it's a great epic story of the English Reformation. And in it, you come away with the impression that Anne and Cromwell were allies. And so that's the position in most of English history. But it's wrong. It's wrong. They weren't allies. They were enemies. They loathed each other. And far from advancing Cromwell's career, Anne held it up, obstructed it. And yet, during the years that she was the wife of the king and queen of England, in effect, Cromwell steadily advancing without the titles you'd expect, the offices you'd expect to symbolize the power he was getting. How can we explain that? Well, I think the king was anxious to give Cromwell power, but was scared of Anne. King Henry VIII was actually quite a cowardly man, and he hated open screaming rows, and it is quite clear that Anne Boleyn was rather good at screaming rows. And so I think you get the picture that the king would stealthily give Cromwell things to do without Anne being taken to the position where she would directly confront the king. So in other words, the central way of looking at the early 1530s and the politics of it is to see Thomas Cromwell with his own agenda and Anne with her own agenda. They're both religious Protestants. But people who share an ideology don't necessarily have to like each other. Just look at modern politics and you'll see the point. And in fact, that the Cromwell's great memory was of his beloved master, the cardinal, whom Anne had destroyed. And so always in their relationship, there was that tension. And in the end, he, Cromwell, destroyed her. If any one man was responsible for Anne being accused of adultery and incest, ridiculous charges, and then being executed, it was Thomas Cromwell.
And it says something about his performance and his abilities that he was able to get to a point, a status, where he could be in a position to make these charges. You describe this ascent to becoming Henry's chief minister in 1534. And it really is a tale of, you know, triumphing through merit.
Yes, and using the system very subtly and cleverly. He did get various formal offices. He became Master of the Jewels, for instance, Clerk of the Hanover, wonderful title, and even Chancellor of the Exchequer, which in the English governmental system now is a very important office. It wasn't then. But each of these rather minor offices gave him a foothold in one or other bits of Tudor government, vital bits. So he could look around government in from these positions and use the position in ways which another man might not. And he's so good at improvising in politics. And that immensely impressed me. The character of his government was constant improvisation, seizing the chance and getting on in that way.
And he uses this to gradually improve his own personal situation, but he also uses it to continue this process of religious reform. Could you elaborate on the ways in which he is shifting England in a more evangelical direction during the 1530s?
Yes, he was constantly making quiet overtures to the Protestant princes in Northern Europe. That's one way, and establishing links there. He was also using very great powers, which Henry VIII had given him, with a brand new title, the Vicegerent in Spirituals. That's a title that no one else has held in English history. And what it meant was that Henry made him deputy in his new Church of England. Just as Cardinal Wolsey had been deputy for the Pope in England, now Cromwell had very similar powers, and he would now use them to gradually shackle the institutions of the Church to the king, and bring the monasteries and the friaries under the king's control, and also to do positive things, as you say, to move England towards the Protestant Reformation. The big goal, the thing which would bring the people of England to Protestantism, would be a Bible in their own language. Now, the Church had forbidden the Bible in English since the early 15th century. It's unusual in Europe that most parts of Europe would have had access to the Bible in their own language, but not England. And Cromwell's greatest achievement, I think, is to gradually, subtly persuade the king, who was not enthusiastic about this project, to give it his backing, flatter the king into thinking that it was his idea. And so actually, after Anne's death, an English Bible was authorized and in fact, made official. A Bible in English, which would largely have been the work of a man called William Tyndale, a translator of genius from the Latin and the Greek and the Hebrew into English. And Tyndale, as his Bible was being authorized by the king, was sitting in a prison cell in the Low Countries, the territory of the Habsburg Roman emperors, Holy Roman emperors, who had arrested him for heresy and went on to execute him with the connivance of Henry VIII. This is the extraordinary thing. The man who allowed Tyndale to die in the emperor's prison was also the man who authorized Tyndale's Bible. And that is thanks to Thomas Cromwell. And it's an extraordinary achievement. Well, I'm not sure that Henry VIII ever realized that this was so. And that's the mark of Cromwell's genius, his improvisation.
I'd like to turn to another aspect of the genius to which you've already made mention, which is his role in the downfall of Anne Boleyn. Could you elaborate upon how what's going on in terms of Henry and his marriages and Cromwell's role, not just in terms of Anne Boleyn's marriage to Henry, but also that of Jane Seymour's?
Yeah, well, good. We have to remember that the relationship between Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn was a passionate love affair. And that's fine for Anne, as long as the passion was love. But she, like her predecessor, had a series of miscarriages and only produced one daughter. And as another miscarriage happened in the winter of 1536, the king's passion turned to disappointment, frustration, and in the end, hatred. And Cromwell was watching. Cromwell was watching, of course. Now, who would be the next heir to the throne if Anne wasn't there? It would be, in fact, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, the Lady Mary, who in the end, to anticipate history, went on to be Mary the First, the Queen Mary the First of England. So Cromwell allied with Mary against Anne, and in doing so gained lots of allies and did not have many friends in the powerful quarters of the land, apart from her family and her various Protestant appointees as bishops. So it's a job of using Mary to push forward an agenda, making sure the king's anger with Anne remained high. And what you can do then is pour poison into the king's ears, which they might have already tried, but now the king was listening. And once the king, King Henry VIII's psychology is that once he has turned against you, he will believe any old nonsense which will be there to justify his hatred. And that's what happened to Anne. So executed on charges of adultery, incest, which are almost certainly utterly untrue. And the next wife along, obscenely quickly, frankly, the next wedding was to Jane Seymour. And now Thomas Cromwell was there, not only the ally of Mary, but also of Jane Seymour's family. Very soon, within a year, his only son, Gregory, was married to Queen Jane Seymour's sister. Thus, Gregory became the king's brother-in-law, and Thomas Cromwell, in an informal sense at least, became the king's uncle. Now, this is extraordinary. You think of this humble boy from the village of Putney is now the king's effective uncle. And think of what it would mean if you're one of the blue-blooded aristocrats of England. You would be outraged and also rather scared. What would happen now you've got this nexus, this link between the Seymour family, who appear to be, they're going to be there in power, and the most powerful minister? What is that going to do to your position, say, as the Duke of Norfolk, the other great power of the court? So a very explosive situation by the end of the 1530s. Poor Jane Seymour, she died in childbirth in 1537, but a son survived, Prince Edward, at last a male heir. And obviously all those relationships still in place to the Cromwells. And all sorts of loose ends in politics from 1537 to 1538, and the story is one of gradual build-up to the crisis which in the end destroyed Thomas Cromwell.
You make an interesting point about that crisis that corrected something that I had, misunderstood, which was the what happened with Anne of Cleves, because you talk about Cromwell's role in terms of arranging the marriage between Henry and his fourth wife, and you point out that we have made certain assumptions about Anne of Cleves that aren't necessarily true. Most famously, that King Henry found her unattractive, and as you point out, that doesn't necessarily hold up with what we know, and that it was probably a much more complex picture than that.
Well, yeah, it's complex complex diplomacy around it and so on. But at the heart of it, there is actually something rather simple, that for reasons which remain utterly mysterious, Henry VIII found this fourth wife who turned up from Cleves utterly loathsome. Anne, poor Anne, has been labeled famously in history as the Flanders Mare. and the story that Holbein, Hans Holbein, the great court portraitist, produced a flattering image of her, which didn't look like her. Actually, this is not true at all, because we have the portrait which the Cleves court had actually had painted of her. And it's now in my own university. It hangs in St. John's College, Oxford. And if you compare that with the Holbein, it is clear they're the same woman. They're, it's recognizable. And the Holbein doesn't really make many changes to it. She looks perfectly fine, as far as I can see. And there is something mysterious about Henry VIII's ideas of beauty and some sort of sexual chemistry which didn't work. And these are lost in the recesses of Henry VIII's mind. But for whatever reason, when poor Anne turned up after a long and arduous journey from Western Germany through Calais, up through Kent, and then the king set eyes on her in at the very end of December 1539, the king loathed her at sight, so disappointed. But he simply couldn't get out of the marriage. So the marriage went ahead in January, a day late, and it must have been the most gloomy marriage of the 16th century, followed by the most gloomy wedding night. But the king was trapped, and the only way that he could get out of this marriage would by having churchmen declare it null and void, declaring it a simple non-marriage. What reason could you give for a non-marriage? Well, the only feasible reason was non-consummation, which, if you simplify the legal language, means the king could not perform a sexual act with her. Can you imagine the arrogant, magnificent Henry VIII having to stand before a group of serious-looking clergy saying, "I'm sorry, I just can't get it up with Queen Anne," and the humiliation of that, and the humiliation would have to be deflected, and who would be the man to deflect it on? Thomas Cromwell, the man who'd set up the marriage in the first place.
Was this the only thing that was souring Henry on Cromwell, or were there other factors at play as well?
Well, around him, an increasingly sour atmosphere because of the way in which many of the nobility, led by the Duke of Norfolk, simply resented his position, which was growing all the time. And Cromwell was, I think, reacting to that by grabbing at more and more power, and in the end, a great ancient title of nobility. He was made Earl of Essex in spring 1540. And, you know, the Earls of Essex stretch back to the Norman Conquest, now the Putney brewer's son, Earl of Essex. And a massive snob like the Duke of Norfolk must have loathed that. So it's not so much the king, but those around the king who would be very prepared to pour poison into the king's ear, just as Cromwell and Anne's enemies had poured poison about Anne into the king's ear. And the problem about being Thomas Cromwell as a servant of Henry VIII is the same problem that Thomas Wolsey had had. You're fine as long as you deliver the goods. And you have to go on delivering the goods, and the king will esteem you and treat you like his favorite son. But the moment you make a mistake, the moment you don't deliver the goods, that's the fatal moment. And that was the moment that the nobility seized on to pour their poison into the king's ear.
You recount the very dramatic moment at which he's arrested, and then you go on to talk about the case that is levied against him. I was wondering if you could summarize that for us and the manner of his death, because it really captures some of the drama, and also it seems to me at the end some a good deal of Cromwell's dignity.
Yes, the atmosphere got very, very manic in late spring 1540, and Cromwell was preparing his coup d'etat against his enemies, and there were arrests of his enemies. And then one afternoon, after a parliamentary session where he'd been at Parliament with all the great nobility and all the members of Parliament, he walked into the Privy Council chamber to find his colleagues with soldiers to arrest him. And that Duke of Norfolk, about whom I spoke, tore the ceremonial George, the symbol of his membership of the Knighthood of the Garter, tore it from his dress and arrested him. He then bundled off to the Tower, never saw the king again. And that's fatal, because if he'd seen the king, he might well have changed the king's mind. All you need to do often with Henry VIII is look him straight in the eye, because this curiously cowardly man hated looking people in the eye. And so Thomas Cromwell was never given that chance by his enemies. So there he was, languishing in the Tower. He wrote letters to the king. The king needed more evidence for why the Anne of Cleves marriage could be annulled, and Cromwell wrote those letters. And there's a very touching one where there's a postscript from Thomas Cromwell in his own hand saying, "Your Grace, I beg you mercy, mercy, mercy." I suspect the king never heard that, because I think the letter would have been read to him by Cromwell's enemies. So no mercy, except that when he did come to the scaffold to be executed, he was not hanged, drawn, and quartered, as he could have been. The charge against him was traitor. Or he could have been burned at the stake, because some of the other charges were heretic. Instead, he was simply beheaded, which is actually the best way to get executed in Tudor England. It's nice and quick. And on the scaffold, there he was. I think by this stage, the king was his anger was abating, because beside Thomas Cromwell on the scaffold stood a friend of his, the famous poet Sir Thomas Wyatt, one was basically a sort of client of Cromwell's. And he'd been allowed to stand with his old friend on the scaffold. And Cromwell gave a very dignified speech, the sort of speech you have to give before you're arrested, before you're executed, and then turned to Thomas Wyatt and said, "Gentle Wyatt, pray for me." And then laid his head on the block, and the king, the executioner, did the deed. So it was a good death, a dignified death. I think the king was soon regretting what he had done.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, something completely different. I'm going back to my other great strand, these huge histories of lots of stuff. And this time, the book will be called Sex and the Church, a History. And it will take us from the origins of Christianity and Judaism and Greek culture through to the present day. And all the things, the very varied things the church has said about sex and gender and marriage. It's a project I've long cherished. I've talked a lot about this subject through my career. It's so important because Western Christianity of the United States and Europe, is so preoccupied by sex at the moment. And a lot of very stupid and silly and simple things are said about sex and the church. And I want to interestingly complicate them. And perhaps the temperature will die down on all the arguments about sex as a result. I hope so anyway.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating, worthy project, and maybe we could have you back to discuss that book when it's done.
I hope so.
Well, Professor McCulloch, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.